Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to today's podcast. In 2012, climate change was not mentioned in any of the three presidential debates for the first time since 1988. Yet Superstorm Sandy probably played a significant role in the re-election of Barack Obama. Such a contradiction highlights the ambivalent relationship Americans have to what is likely the greatest challenge facing our species and our planet. And today we're going to focus on climate and the wider issue of humanity's relationship to the natural world. Randy Hayes, the former head of the Rainforest Action Network, currently the executive director of Foundation Earth, whose primary work these days he describes as rethinking and ecologizing the economy. While Balog offers evidence of some symptoms of our way of life, the consequences of our actions, Hayes is attempting to develop radical approaches to economics that will enable us to deal with the underlying causes. Randy Hayes is a climate policy officer at the World Future Council, a global forum composed of 50 individuals from around the world championing the rights of future generations and working to ensure that humanity acts now for a sustainable future. Hayes is the founder of Rainforest Action Network, a veteran of many high-visibility corporate accountability campaigns. He served as president to the city of San Francisco Commission on the Environment, as director of sustainability in the office of Oakland Mayor Jerry Brown, now Governor Jerry Brown. Hayes has a master's degree in environmental planning from San Francisco State, and his master's thesis, I thought this was interesting, The Four Corners, won the Academy of Motion Pictures Arts and Sciences Award for Best Documentary back in 1983. So, welcome again, Randy.
No, it's quite good to be here.
Yeah. Now, you and I have known each other a while. You've been on the show a few times. I want to start out by asking you.
I think it was the late 1800s when we met.
I think it was. And things have improved on some ways, and they've fallen back others since then. But a couple of big questions I want to begin with. I know that you spent time in your youth on a Hopi reservation. How did that happen? Why did you do it? What did you learn? And how has that influenced your life?
Well, interesting you bring that up, because tomorrow I head towards the Grand Canyon and just north of the Painted Desert to, of all things, spend Thanksgiving dinner with some of the Hopi elders.
Excellent.
And my friends down there. I try to check in once a year, but I did live off and on there for 10 years when I finished undergraduate school, which was at Bowling Green State University in Ohio, for a number of reasons. I headed west, and I ended up out with the elders, where unofficially I was kind of secretary and chauffeur to the Hopi elders. And
how long did
that
you stay?
I consider my real graduate training in deep sustainability and long-term thinking.
And
they have lived for 10,000 years in that desert as farmers in a rather peaceful and sustainable way.
Yeah. Now, how long did you stay?
Well, from 1973 to 1983, essentially.
Okay.
83 is when we released the documentary, The Four Corners, A National Sacrifice Area, where we looked at the coal and uranium mining on Hopi Navajo lands in the southwest on the Colorado Plateau.
And so, as you said, you feel like that's really your graduate education. How has what you did day to day, what you saw, what you thought about, the perspectives you were surrounded by for those 10 years, influenced the rest of your life?
How has it influenced the rest of my terror, my subsequent to that time?
Yeah.
I learned that the Hopi were, this culture was a dramatically different worldview than our industrial European mindset. They lived in this fragile ecological system where they had to, you know, handle the assaults from insensitive governments and transnational corporations. And effectively, that was the same dilemma the native peoples were having in the tropical rainforests of the Amazon or the Central Africa, the Congo, or Southeast Asia's rainforests in Borneo and other places. So the lessons that I learned there about how to interface and listen a lot to understand the worldview of other cultures, how to support them to stop some of the heinous activities of some of the transnational corporations and how to help them interface with rather insensitive government bureaucracies. It applied directly to all of my tropical rainforest work for the next couple of decades.
Now, I'm hearing two things in that. Let me see if you're meaning both of them. One is that these other cultures were the cultures of the indigenous people, the cultures of the Hopi. But you say, I learned how to relate to other cultures. Did that also then influence or maybe help your ability to talk to the corporate powers that be?
Yeah, it does. Sometimes they actually need a translator. And the son of one of the elders, Thomas Binyakya, many of your listeners will know that name, his son, Tommy Jr., he and I are the same age, and, you know, in our 20s and 30s down there, he and I could sort of be a dual bridge between the outer world and the inner world, so to speak, between, you know, the Hopi world and the industrial world, and it was a good partnership that we carry on to this day. And while I was at Hopi, I met indigenous people from all parts of the planet. That's really where I first, of all things, I was there in the high deserts of northern Arizona, and that's where I learned about the tropical rainforest problem, because indigenous peoples from the rainforests of Hawaii, the native Hawaiians, South America, and even Australia. You know, I was a geographically ignorant American. I thought Australia was just a big desert. But, you know, the northern parts of Australia are tropical rainforests and aren't that far from places like Papua New Guinea.
And so you what you're saying is deposited in this out-of-the-way place in America's Southwest, you actually came into contact with indigenous from all over the world.
Yeah, it's a nodal point on the planet, you know, like an acupuncture point for the planet. I mean, Tibetan lamas would often sort of roll through town, you know, and hang out.
Yeah, that sounds so remarkable.
Wow, and you learn strange little things, like the Hopi word for sun is the Tibetan word for moon, and the Hopi word for moon is the Tibetan word for sun. You know, and physically they look so much alike. You know, in their mythologies, the Hopi believe we've lived three other highly technological civilizations, which all collapsed. The last one by a flood, similar to Noah's flood,
mm-hmm.
And that was because technology got out of sync with the cycles of nature. That's one of the main lessons that I learned there. But I also learned, you know, in terms of appreciating other cultures while I was hanging out with Tibetans, you know what the Tibetan word for tree is?
No idea.
I mean, it essentially means foot drinker.
Wow, yeah.
When you think of a tree as drinking through its roots,
yeah,
right, a foot drinker, you begin to see a cyclic process of the water being sucked up through the roots and evaporating through the leaves into the clouds that rain down and the roots suck it all up. It's a cyclic way of thinking about life, and that's what they mean by a sacred language, like Sanskrit and Hopi and other language. English is not a very sacred language, and what I mean by sacred language is actually functional. It mimics reality, and reality is cyclic. You know, we have great cycles. We have life support systems in the biosphere that are run by the carbon cycles and the weather cycles, and of course, our industrial ways are disrupting that.
Yeah, as I often say when people say, what do you mean a world that just might work? What is your kind of view of all this? I say one of the basic statements is the conventional, at least U.S., belief seems to be that reality is dead, separate, independent, those sorts of things, static, and my experience, whether from modern science or from stepping outside and looking at nature around me or the eyes of another human being, is that reality is alive, dynamic, and interdependent. Talk a little, if you will, about the evolution of your approach to the issues that you focus on. In other words, in the past, when you were still at Rainforest Action Network, we talked about the evolution from confrontation to basically ally and advisor. And now that you've left Rainforest Action Network as your primary focus and are in this, if you will, startup at Foundation Earth, obviously there's a new stage in your evolution. Can you talk about that process?
Sure. Yeah, I'm still on the board of Rainforest Action Network.
I know, that's why I said primary. Yeah.
Becky Tarabotten is the executive director, and she's doing heroic work with the organization and carrying on the good fight. There are many niches that need to be filled. And, you know, the sort of saber-rattling of Rainforest Action Network taking on transnational corporations and the World Bank and the World Trade Organization and such, you know, it's fundamental to put pressure on these characters and demand that they make changes. In many cases, it's the only reason that they do, whether it was, you know, defeating Burger King around the purchase of Rainforest beef or Home Depot around the being the largest retailer in the world of wood products, you know, or Citibank that was financing illegal logging in Southeast Asia. But heroic as all of that is, it's also insufficient. We need to carry it on, but we need other things. And I needed to step away and better understand a few other strategies. So I went into 7 years of green city government where I could understand kind of localization and bioregional thinking. And that was a very rewarding experience. But David Brower, who built the Sierra Club and founded and built the Friends of the Earth, you know, I logged a lot of time. He and Benyakia, one of the elders at Hopi, we would hang out together a lot. And David Brower, towards the end of his days, would say, well, he'd come to understand that the most important environmental policy was economic policy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we'd have these conversations, and I've taken that to heart and come to understand that if we can't ecologize capitalism or come up with a better ism, you know, then what we're doing is brush fire fighting. And after two or three decades of, you know, two steps forward and three steps backwards, that's just not a winning strategy. We don't have enough ground troops to fight enough brush fires. And so we need to look at those medium and long-term changes in society as we continue to fight these ever-important brush fires. And for me, it's about ecologizing the economy, and I can tell you what I mean by that in fairly precise ways, and I think it's really quite exciting because there's a conversation that can be had right now that, you know, 5 or 15 years ago would have been difficult to have.
Before we do that, Randy, if you would, you kind of, you know, I think in an aim to get to what's exciting you right now, you dealt with the city government part in, you know, a couple of sentences.
Yeah.
What was that like? I mean, for a listener, I'm sure they're going to say, okay, Randy Hayes was, you know, activist.
I have 18 civil disobedience arrests under my belt. You
know? Exactly.
What the hell am I doing with a suit and tie hanging out with Mayor Willie Brown or Mayor Gavin Newsom or Mayor Jerry Brown?
Yeah.
And the city councils and boards of supervisors. And I can tell you, it was just fantastic in a number of ways, because we're talking about Northern California and places like Oakland and California. In San Francisco, I was president of the Commission on the Environment for 5 years, appointed by Willie Brown and then served under Gavin Newsom. And the commission had no real political power, but its mandate was to advise the Board of Supervisors and the mayor on environmental policy, and they passed everything our commission gave them.
Wow.
Right, including a very gutsy precautionary principle policy that many of your listeners will know the precautionary principle, but in short form, it just simply means if something's potentially cataclysmic, when in doubt, play it safe.
You right,
know,
and let me just
raises her children, right? You know, you don't let them play kickball next to a busy street when you've got a fenced-in backyard.
And let me just say that the common legal setup in the U.S. is, whether it's the FDA or the EPA and so on, is that it's sort of to let people or corporations try things, and then if danger, if consequences show up, then begin to see if the science backs up the consequences and blah, blah, blah. What this says is the opposite approach. If it might be toxic, let's err on the side of caution rather than...
Sure, and you put the burden of proof on the perpetrator. If it's a company that has a new chemical they want to spread via industrial agriculture, the burden of proof should be on them to prove it's safe, not onto the farm workers who end up getting cancer.
Exactly. So the city of San Francisco passed such a principle, which means what? Which means that only their agencies have to follow it, or companies within their jurisdiction?
Actually, it's the city agencies,
mm-hmm.
and this is how you often set the precedent
mm-hmm.
for the larger laws down the line. But it also reflects kind of an ecological economics principle. A simple example, say you got, every city's got to clean windows. And say you've got a huge purchasing department, and you're talking millions and millions of dollars every 12 months in a lot of these cities, purchasing things. And they use the precautionary principle when they purchase something as simple as window cleaners. Because you might have three. One of them is a known carcinogen, i.e. cancer-causing, so you don't buy it. One of them is a suspected carcinogen, and it's a cheap price. And one of them might be something as analogous as to household vinegar, and it's a few cents more. The law is written so that the city can buy something that's even a little bit more expensive, because there's no active questioning about its toxicity problems or its safety. The city uses that in terms of buying bus engines, in terms of buying household cleaners, in terms of buying all kinds of things. And you can contact the Department of the Environment in San Francisco, and they'll be glad to talk to you about how it's being utilized.
Very good. And let me just say, my guest next week is Ralph Nader, about his new book, 17 Solutions.
Yeah.
And I've recorded the interview already. And one of his solutions, of course, is using the power of government procurement to move things forward. And as you indicated, a city, a county, a state, a federal government has enormous purchasing power. And when they set the bar higher, whether it's for worker rights, for environmental effects and so on, they can bring down the price for everyone else and really create the market. And so I just want to point out that there's a lot of things at play here.
Yeah, Ralph's a heroic person and a friend, and I'm largely based in Washington, D.C., so I get a chance to go over to his office from time to time and conspire on, on these solutions. And he and his dedicated staff are really doing carrying on, some heroic solutions.
Yeah, and I highly recommend to folks next week at this time an hour interview with Ralph. And the thing that struck me the most, Randy, was his energy and his optimism. You figure he's 78 at this point, and you figure, he's had a lot of battles. He's won some, he's lost some, he's been praised, he's been assailed, and so on. I was impressed by the energy and enthusiasm that he displays, and it is absolutely at the core of why his latest book is 17 Solutions and not 17 Problems.
Yeah, it reminds me of the energy that Jerry Brown has.
Yeah, exactly.
Him, because Jerry...
75, I think.
...for years, there I was a commissioner in San Francisco, and Jerry called me up one day, and he said, I want to have a position in the city government called the Director of Sustainability. It'll be right in the mayor's office. I want you to help me write the job description and find somebody to fill it. So I worked on the job description and for a director, and I believe it's the first city in the world that's ever had such a title, and now there are many with that title or titles quite close to that. But and then as I thought about who could fill that, I kept thinking how exciting it would be to do that job, and I pulled essentially a Dick Cheney.
I was just going to make the reference.
Yeah, W. Bush had put Cheney in charge of helping him pick his vice presidential candidate. So I nominated myself, and then we went at it, passing green building ordinances for the city, getting 5 megawatts of solar power installed, and many other things.
So before we leave this...
We even worked with some people to set up a green city competition and when I was at San Francisco initially, and then more so at Oakland, but San Francisco came in, I think, second in year one and first in year two. And then after a year of working at Oakland, we got Oakland, I think, number seven on the list. And now they've expanded it from a top 10 to a top 20 Green City competition, and it's a quite friendly and collegial competition.
Sure. Sure, learn from each other. I'm speaking with Randy Hayes, former head of Rainforest Action Network, founder of Rainforest Action Network, currently the executive director of Foundation Earth. His primary work, he says, is ecologizing the economy at this point. And you can learn more about that work at FDN Earth. One word, FDNEarth.org. Before we leave the time you spent in city, in city governments, what was the biggest sort of thing you learned and the thing that surprised you the most about working in that, given, as we say, it was San Francisco, it was Jerry Brown, but still, it's municipal government?
Yeah, it is. It is. But the voluntarism in government and maybe that's the wrong word, not so much voluntarism, but most people who go into, like, city council races or board of supervisor races, you know, it's not like they went to took any classes on how to govern. And they really depend on a broad set of characters to come up with the solutions, and there's a lot of room for bottom-up solutions to emerge in a city government. A lot of the ideas of things that we passed came from the citizens and directly. When I was president of the Commission on the Environment, I would hold public hearings once a month and invite any and everybody, and we did a lot of outreach, and sometimes we'd even just go out into different neighborhoods just because, you know, it's not always easy for people, even with the good public transit of San Francisco, to get to City Hall. We'd go out into the Mission District and Hunters Point and other places and hold our hearings, and you get some inspired people out there with some great ideas, and we'd say, look, come back to us. And, you know, we'll roll up our sleeves and work with you, and let's present something to the mayor and the city council, and, you know, let's get this going. So what I learned was that there, at that scale, at that kind of regional, local scale, the opportunity to really affect things and make change is enormous. And that leads to a lot of state governments eventually picking it up.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes leads to a national government.
Right. And as a point that's been made on this program many times is that when the big moneyed interests are fighting their battles, my sense is that they focus most at the national level and then at the state level, and so that in fact the chances for good happening, the chances for good getting something done without the opponents having time or energy or focus to marshal the opposition, very much happens in this bottom-up way, from neighborhoods to cities, to regions and states and so on, and that in terms of climate, in terms of so many things, that really is what seems to be where the real solutions are coming from.
Yeah, it works beautifully from time to time. It's quite uplifting.
Yeah. Okay, let's switch to your current work. Foundation Earth, I'm going to read a very quick thing on your website. At Foundation Earth, our vision, our cause, is getting the human economy in sync with nature's ways and aid the continued viability of the biosphere, the planet's life support system. How did it come into being, and how is it evolving for you?
Well, it's exciting. It's been you know, a couple of years in sort of concept, and just a year in when we actually formed the legal structure of Foundation Earth. But I'm working with Andy Kimbrell, who founded and directs the Center for Food Safety, who was very involved in the GMO ballot initiative in California. He sues Monsanto on GMOs and often wins. Also, Brent Blackwelder, the former executive director, president of Friends of the Earth, stepped down from that position, but he's helping me here at Foundation Earth, and so we're working with another set of advisors, Diane Dumanowski, who is a science writer from the Boston Globe, and Ty Cashman up in Mill Valley, California, who's a systems thinker and a student of history, all towards, you know, coming up with a short list of projects that we're now starting to raise some monies to implement. One of them was for the UN Earth Summit, Rio+20, that happened last June down in Brazil. And we created a report card on what you could call the paradigm shift to a better world, you know, on the economic rethink. We came up with 16 initiatives around the planet that that different governments are enacting, and some of them are economic policy, some of them are environmental policy, and some of them are social equity policy related. And that gives you a kind of a holistic approach around which to see. But no one country is doing the 16 initiatives that we came up with, but you could imagine if one country started to do most of them, hey, we'd be really getting somewhere. I mean, this would be the great societal U-turn to a better world.
Right. And what you do in that report is you do say, so who is doing this piece well? Right.
Yeah.
And so
it's a good news.
Yeah, exactly. It's full
Most
of good news.
Report cards are about how bad things are and how screwed up it is. It's really depressing because we reviewed about 25 global indicators. You know, like even the ecological footprint just tells you essentially how out of kilter you are with nature's ways. But there's things like the gender equity index and the happiness in the gross happiness index and such that really help you understand which countries are the real leaders out there. And it's countries like Sweden and Costa Rica and the Netherlands and Cuba's food program and New Zealand's government integrity program and the Basque over in Spain and their cooperatives, the Mondragon cooperatives, show us the different business models. It's just the examples are really uplifting.
Yeah, and I must say,
we took all of those and we compared them against Brazil.
Mm-hmm.
We were down in Brazil, and Brazil didn't do too terribly well, even though they were hosting this green economy UN Earth Summit. They're going back to wanting to build hydroelectric dams in the Amazon and things that are just unacceptable.
Mm. So if you go to the Foundation Earth website, which I said is fdnearth.org, you can find this report, right? It's what's the title of it again?
It's called the Economic Rethink, Who Does It Well?
Right. So it is the report they made to Brazil, but as we said, it highlights all these aspects, who is already doing things and who are the models to look at and so on. One quick thing you mentioned, and we may get back to it, the cooperatives, the Mondragon cooperatives in the Basque section of Spain. And one of the things that has really been, it may not be, you know, common knowledge, but it is quite a big deal, is that anybody who's following the Eurozone crisis right now knows Spain is in real trouble, but not that section of Spain. It's almost, you probably know this, Randy, but that section of Spain does things differently than most of the rest of Spain, didn't get caught up in the casino games of the rest of it, it's interesting to find a country that within its borders has problems like so many other countries in much of it, and then has this section that is like the beacon of success, and it really says something because you're pointing it out not because, you know, you're pointing it out because of, you know, how it comes closer to aligning with nature's ways. Well, it turns out it's also a hell of a lot more successful economically.
Yeah, I know, it's more stable.
Right.
More stable economy.
So let's talk about, you deal a lot in your current work with the notions of true cost and externalities. True cost being the goal, externalities being the distraction, if you will, or the excuse. Tell people a little bit what we mean by those two concepts.
Sure. You can picture a coal-fired power plant, right? It's spewing a lot of toxicity into the air from its smokestack. You got the particulate that gives children with asthma attacks, and, you know, a mother may have to take her little child into the emergency room for that asthma attack. and she will then have to pay the price for that visit to the emergency room when it was caused by the coal-fired power plant. Coal-fired power plant is also spewing a lot of mercury. A lot of you know about the buildup of mercury in fish and why we can't eat too many of certain types of fish anymore. What you may not know is that the primary source of that mercury comes from coal-fired power plants. Mercury occurs naturally in coal formations. It's a metal. When the coal's burned, it doesn't disappear. It just, vaporizes, so to speak, but then it drifts down into the oceans and it accumulates up through the fish. You know, who pays the price for that? Well, not the coal-fired power plant. And so, right now, the things like the particulate and the asthma attack and the hospital bill, they're external to the price you pay for the electricity from that coal-fired power plant. The coal-fired power plants, they're in the business of selling electricity, right? But it's the price of that electricity doesn't accurately reflect all of the cost to society and to the future. And so a true cost society would better reflect those kinds of things. And if we had more true cost pricing with energy, then wind and solar would be cheaper per kilowatt hour right now and not more expensive. That leads you to a principle, which is in a true cost economy, the cleanest things, the ecologically cleanest things are the cheapest. Or the cheapest things in the sense of getting a bargain at the store are the ecologically cleanest. You know, and if you think about it, organic tomatoes should be cheaper than toxic tomatoes.
Right.
Or organic cotton should be cheaper than toxic cotton. We shouldn't even really call it, say, organic, agriculture or food. It's just food, and then the other stuff is toxic food.
Right.
Right.
So for people, if that went by at all quickly, what it is that we all pay one way or the other.
Yeah.
We pay health costs, we pay pollution costs, we pay all of these things. We pay them one way or the other. The setup, and you may agree with this, Randy, I can't remember who it was on this program many years ago, might have been David Corton, who knows, might have been Herman Daly, who said that actually, if you look at an awful lot of corporations, their whole profit, their whole business model is exactly the amount that they don't pay that they should. In other words, their whole economic business model is based on, if I can just keep from paying that cost, that's my profit. And so what I'm saying is, you, the customer, or society at large, will ultimately pay. The question is whether that cost is included in the cost of the product, or the product comes out cheaply and you pay that cost in healthcare, you pay that cost in remediation of the environment and so on. And what you're saying is that when we can move to economics actually breaking that false disconnection, if you will, and actually including all the costs that will ultimately be paid in the sale price of a product or a service, then the market, which we all rely on so much, will actually be an accurate market and then could actually help us make decisions, versus now, to some extent, the market distracts us because it doesn't reflect the true cost of many of the things that's involved in it. You agree? That pretty good?
Yeah, that works for me.
Okay.
Cheater economics is our label for the current system. You know, it just sort of.
What did you call it?
Cheater economics.
Cheater, exactly.
So what we don't like is cheater economics, and what we do need is a true cost economy. And yeah, some things will get more expensive, but if that saves life on Earth and stops the demise of the life support systems of the biosphere, I think a lot of future generations would quite appreciate that. But the truth is, you know, all the overconsumption and waste going on in society has got to be dealt with, and we can live much more cheaply. People in California use half the electricity than the rest of the country. They don't live a bad life.
That's right. That's right. And part of it has to do with the weather in this state. But I thought you were going to make a comparison to what we used 25, 30 years ago. That's what's interesting, is that California has not always been so energy efficient, or when we've hit certain crises, we've learned to do things differently. And also, we've done it with water. We are much more efficient with our use of water than we used to be. And but what it says is, so can, and so can the rest of the country. And this country is half as efficient as Western Europe.
That's right.
In terms of energy, and I believe in terms of water and other things as well. So there's a great deal of low-hanging fruit, actually, toward getting to some of these things where things work more correctly. Let me just read a couple of quotes from your paper about externalities. Externalities are things outside of a financial transaction, and such as toxic heavy metal mining waste pumped into a nearby river. In a closed system, which essentially describes the biosphere, there are no externalities, and that's the point: is that it's an illusion. Who is doing a good job these days of eliminating externalities and developing true cost?
Well, I only have a partial answer to that. We have set up a new project, and we just got initial funding to essentially put pressure on the Security Exchange Commission. We want them to require all corporations to declare their pollution externalities once a year on their financial forms. And that's a step, you know, towards, and have that information be publicly available so people can take a look at that. Well, we need to shine the light of day on these hidden costs. But in terms of getting closer to a true cost economy, let's just start with the concept of a carbon tax.
Right.
A carbon tax is a polluter pay principle. You know, if you dump that toxicity into the atmosphere, you got to pay a price per ton. And the idea is that you know, puts the incentives in a better, you know, better incentives to reduce the emissions of that toxicity. But Sweden has a carbon tax. Costa Rica, as a nation state, has a carbon tax. The province of British Columbia has a carbon tax, and I believe Australia recently passed a carbon tax that'll go into effect soon.
And one of the, if
that's
I could, if
a good
I,
example, and those are a few countries
and entities. Let me just jump in on that, which is to say, you see, what happens when you do that is you've now made the cost so that now people will make market decisions that reflect the carbon in it. I will tell you, I did some, in preparing for this interview, Randy, I was Googling a bit, and at one point this week, and I don't know if you saw this, Grover Norquist said he would be open to a carbon tax if it were revenue neutral, that is to say, if it meant a reduction in income tax. And within 2 days, he had been gotten to, and he totally disavowed that he'd ever said that.
Oh, God.
But
That's not surprising.
Yeah.
Too bad, because he was doing the right thing for a change.
Exactly. It blew my mind. What we're talking about there is the notion of taxing bads rather than goods.
Exactly.
And in other words, America bases so much of its taxation on labor, on work, which we want people to do. And we could do a revenue neutral, although at this point we can't afford a revenue neutral because we've got to raise more revenue because of our situation, our economic situation. But basically, if you reduce income taxes, because what we want is people to work, and you tax things we don't want, we do it already with alcohol, with cigarettes, but carbon is the thing that where it would have the most sort of the biggest and most important effect. And it is, I must say, a carbon tax is in the conversation these days, and it hasn't been, I don't think, since 1992. If you recall, it was briefly talked about at the beginning of the Clinton-Gore administration.
Yeah.
And although the Obama administration has said it will not do it.
Yeah, and they didn't lose the vote. Actually, that came up in the very early on in the Clinton-Gore. Their first major environmental initiative was a carbon tax, and it didn't lose by very much.
That's right.
They got hammered in the press, and they got hammered by industry, and they backed way off from it because the social change movement didn't really rise up to support them. You know, it's rare that elected officials are really leaders.
Exactly.
Exceptions. the real leadership, you know, the elected officials. And on one level, I think you can't blame them to want reelectability. If they see getting out there in a leadership role is so detrimental to getting reelected, well, you know, what do you want to do? Turn the world over to another Dick Cheney? I don't think so. And so the only way they can really afford to be bold is when the social change network gives them a bit of a safety net.
Right, and I think at that point, Gore came in as vice president. I assume that was something that he may have initiated, and the people were caught off guard. And the support, as you say, the support was not there. Some other things in your elements that you talk about in your rethink. You say applying true cost economy and carrying capacity thinking to agriculture shapes a more organic, healthy, decentralized, and resilient system. Talk about that and tell us who does it well.
Sure. You know, if you look at the global economic system, you know, corporate-led economic globalization or global capitalism or whatever label you want to put on it, the two main things it does poorly from an ecological standpoint is it doesn't systematically internalize those pollution externalities and hence get rid of them. And it also doesn't have institutional mechanisms to ratchet economic activity down when it's approaching a carrying capacity limit. Just think of a simple example like the fish in the ocean. You know, we have some regulatory power here and there, but there's no really effective institutions that ratchet economic activity down. That's what a cap and trade program is trying to do in the sense of carbon and climate change. It really should have been called cap and reduce, and we would understand that it was dealing with a carrying capacity issue. The atmosphere can only absorb so much before the weather systems go haywire and you have superstorms that, you know, cause a lot of damage and a lot of death. And so those are the two problems that we have to fix. If one says, okay, we need to ecologize the economy, the two main activities are about internalizing pollution externalities systematically and making sure that we stay beneath carrying capacity limits globally, continentally, and in our biological regions.
And carrying capacity for someone to whom that's a new term.
Sure. You know, you could just think about an animal population in a valley, you know. There's only so much sort of food for the rabbits, you know. And if you overeat the food for the rabbits, there's going to be a die-off. So there's nature has a way of getting in what they call dynamic balance or dynamic equilibrium where, you know, a valley can carry a certain number of species on an ongoing sustainable way. And planet Earth, you know, we're 7 billion people right now with varying levels of lifestyle and consumption patterns, but we need to look at the carrying capacity of the planet and figure out how to get in sync with that.
Right. And so as you were saying, one is that one thing about actual accurate pricing, a true cost economy would signal pollution has costs, and two, it would give us signals as to when we're overreaching, right? And you point out that Cuba has done a good job with agriculture. What happened? What is the story of what happened in Cuba?
It's very interesting, and there's a film on it, which I can't recall the title right now, but essentially, you know, a lot of your listeners are familiar with peak oil and the whole issue around the fact that if we've discovered and extracted sort of half of the oil in the future, we're going to be discovering less and less as the desire for more is there, and hence the price will get, you know, will skyrocket. And a lot of our agriculture is affected by fossil fuel, you know, in the transport of the foods, but also in the fertilizers and the pesticides and such.
Yeah, so, conventional, a big agribusiness is in many ways a petroleum industry.
Exactly.
Yeah.
In fact, some people contend that if you aggregate all of the fossil fuel emissions related to agriculture, including the pesticides and fertilizers and such, It's the number one sort of emitter and problem in terms of greenhouse gas global warming. But when the Soviet Union broke up, they sent cheap oil to Cuba. They subsidized the oil to Cuba and the fossil fuels. They subsidized the fertilizers and the pesticides and such, the stuff of bad agriculture, the stuff that's soil destroying over time. And, you know, a friend of mine once said, you know, a good farmer doesn't grow food, a good farmer grows soil. And so when the Soviet Union broke up and Cuba didn't have that subsidized, you know, fossil fuels, they had to grapple with that. But they were able, in their biological region, on their island, they were able to rally to that and really aggressively go into urban agriculture and, you know, what we called victory farms or victory gardens in back in World War II days. And they started growing a lot of food and developing greater regional self-reliance. And because they couldn't afford toxic pesticides and toxic fertilizers, it's a much more organic agriculture. They may be slipping these days in the last few years in terms of growing sufficient quantities of food, but they made great gains at being far more self-reliant. And ultimately, we see here at Foundation Earth, think of it just continentally, you know, a network of bioregional economies that are largely self-reliant in terms of the, you know, energy and food that they utilize and consume, and a certain amount of trade between those, and we could have a pretty good life. So Cuba sets an example for how that happened.
And they got forced into it, as we said. That's the voice of Randy Hayes, currently the executive director of Foundation Earth, and we're talking about Foundation Earth's work, which is basically, at these days, to rethink and ecologize the economy. You can learn more at fdnearth.org. We've got just about 3 or 4 minutes. I'm going to tick off some of the other elements you talk about. Public banking. We had Alan Brown on the show a few weeks ago. Public banking as something which is part of this vision. Empowerment of women, income equality, an adjustment of high consumption lifestyles. How do you deal with the folks in the world living on $2 and $3 a day?
Well, on one level, I kind of reject that financial way of defining things, but it's not unimportant, as we all know. You know, when I visit, you know, a tribe in the Amazon that's still largely self-reliant, you know, I don't think of them as poor people.
They fall into that number, but they don't necessarily feel that way.
Yeah, they're culturally rich. They have vibrant communities and relationships. They have a high degree of self-reliance. They have high art and culture and ceremonies and, you know, it's why I continue to go down to hang out with the Hopi. You know, they still speak their language quite a bit, and they still have their ceremonial cycle, and yet a lot of them, you know, are living on a heck of a lot less than many of us, but living quite successfully. You know, I'm a believer in societies having social safety nets to help people in need, and that's a very important you know way to do things. Essentially, there's two tasks. We need to help consumers get down to sustainable levels of production and consumption, and we have to help. There are under-consumers. If you're malnourished or starving, you're an under-consumer, and we have to help those people get up to a dignified level of production and consumption. The real damage being done to the Earth is from the over-consumer.
Sure.
If you think of, like, even the ozone depletion, that was not the overpopulating hordes of the equatorial world. That was an inappropriate technology that was championed by the industrial economy, you know, chlorofluorocarbons that was destroying the ozone. So at any rate, we need to have both programs. We need to really come up with and create institutions for overconsumption reduction. And, you know, there are lots of existing efforts to help people out of poverty, and that has to carry on as well.
Okay, let me give you a last question, and I'll give you about a minute and a half. If you could stand in the future, 20 or 25 years in the future, and you look back, did we turn things around? And if so, how did we do it?
I would say that extreme weather events were critical to it. Let's just say that we did turn things around, because a lot could change in 25 years for the good, actually. But we don't have the political will right now to address the problem on a scale commensurate with the problem. You know, it's very hard to get rid of, you know, the perverse subsidies to the oil and gas industry, because their lobby power is powerful, right? So there's a reason why these problems aren't getting solved. But as a Katrina, a Category 5 hurricane like Katrina hits, and we see and feel the devastation at our solar plexus level, as a superstorm hits, you know, New York and New Jersey, and we get the sense that, you know, oh, Mother Earth is getting spastic on us. That's what an extreme weather event is. It's an ecospasm.
Yeah.
And these ecospasms, it's sad that it takes that to wake people up to want to change on a scale commensurate with the problem. But if I were standing 25 years from now, I'd say that that was critical. But at least when it happened, we were ready there, because we had the bold ideas, the windows of opportunity opened up, and we jammed them through.
Okay, very good. We've been talking with Randy Hayes about rethinking and ecologizing the economy, and you can learn more at fdnearth.org. That's Foundation Earth, fdnearth.org. You can listen to this week's conversation and many others anytime during the week by linking to the podcast. You can sign up to have it delivered to you weekly, either at iTunes or at my site. And my site is terrencemcnally.net, terrencemcnally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com, one long word, a world that just might work. They're the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcement telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and three or four articles to give you a background on the issues, you can sign up at my site or by emailing me at temcnally, T-E-M-C-N-A-L-L-Y, at mac.com. You can also check out Free Forum with Terrence McNally on Facebook and follow me on Twitter at McNally Terrence. Finally, thank you to Randy Hayes. Keep up your good work.